podcast is created as a part of the Podcast Lab by India Film Project in association with Anchor by Spotify. You, me, films, and the world is equal to this podcast. No, take two. You, me, and just geeking about films is equal to this podcast you're listening to. This is Around the World in 8mm. I am Prakhar Patidar and I talk films. I want to start this episode by talking about mental health. This concerns us not because it's a core theme in the film, but because it's an important part of our lives. And I say this with awareness that it's easier said than done and it asks for a lot of courage. But if you are going through something, please try and reach out to the people you trust. Seek help. You are loved and deserve the world. If you know someone who might be struggling with something, lend an ear. Be there when you're needed. If anyone ever needs to vent or rant or just converse, please reach out. Let's talk. Not just about films, but anything you feel like talking about. I sincerely hope that no one falls into such deep loneliness that reality blurs into the background as they plunge into a self-destructive pitfall of delusion. That is exactly something that happens with Travis Bickle, a Vietnam War Marine, honorably discharged, and now a taxi driver because he can't sleep. This is one character you pity and unwillingly root for, despite knowing he does not deserve your sympathy. He's openly racist, he's so toxic, he's entitled, has savior complex, and goes on to do some really violent stuff. And yet, there you are with him throughout the film, eagerly waiting to see how far he'll go, and hoping whatever that limit is, does not end too badly for him. And that happens when you have Paul Schrader's writing, Martin Scorsese's direction, and Robert De Niro's acting. I refuse to believe that this film would have been as iconic had it been any other combination of talent but these three. It's amazing how Schrader writes an embodiment of pathological loneliness, which, by the way, comes from lived experience, not pathological, but a few weeks of no human interaction that inspires Schrader to write about loneliness and isolation. And when talking about his writing process, and it's quite interesting, he says, how he generally creates his stories is he starts with a problem that can be represented through a metaphor and then plots the story around this conflict between the metaphor and the problem. For example, in Taxi Driver, you have loneliness as the central problem. Our protagonist and what he does is the metaphor for it. And the film is about his struggles with progressively increasing isolation and ensued loneliness. In the following segment, let's talk about all three, the writing, the direction, and the acting. Because we simply cannot not talk about all three. But first, let us have a look at an overview of Bickle's world. Taxi Driver is the story of a deeply troubled man. He can't sleep despite working all day and spending hours at Mon Theatre, so he decides to drive taxi in New York at night. He doesn't have any qualms about going to any parts of the city, just wants to get through the night. Bickle is clearly struggling with PTSD, a term that did not even exist at the time the film was being written and made. Well, of course, the disorder existed, we just did not have proper definitive terms for it. He is deeply dissatisfied with what he sees around him, the streets of New York, the sex and drugs infused side of the city that comes out after the sun goes down, and wishes for some cleansing rain to clean off all the filth. He's also a lost man looking for a purpose in life, wanting to matter. He says,
all my life needed was a sense of some place to go. I don't believe that one should devote his life to morbid self-attention. I believe that someone should become a person like other people.
He says this, but does exactly the opposite. The whole film, he's morbidly self-centered and thinks his purpose is to save the woman he desires because he believes she feels the same disconnect from those around her as he does. But the catch is, he cannot have the woman he desires because she comes from a very different social background. And the woman he can have, who is a child prostitute, by the way, a 12-year-old child prostitute, played by the amazing Jodie Foster. So the woman he can have is the one he doesn't desire. It's really fucked up, I know. Betsy, the woman he desires, is working on a political campaign for a candidate in the presidential race, someone Bickle has no idea about, but his posters make it to Bickle's apartment later. Things we do to impress our crush, no? When his paths cross with Iris, the child prostitute, she hurriedly enters Bickle's cab, trying to escape her pimp. It's like New York is presenting its worst side to a man who does not need any more reasons to resent New York. And Bickle decides he must save her too. Remember, this is a man looking for a purpose. A man plagued with existential grief, not in a way that connects you to humanity, because not knowing what's it all for is a collective lack we all face. He is plagued with it in a way that singles him out, disconnects him from reality, and whatever parts of reality he chooses to see, the ugly, filthy ones, give him a sense of superiority and an entitlement to take action against it. He calls himself God's lonely man. The prime example of the morbid self-indulgence he disapproves of, proving Betsy's judgment of him right on the first date, she says.
Sure, you know what you remind me of?
What?
That song by Kris Kristofferson.
Who's that?
The songwriter. He's a prophet. He's a prophet and a pusher. Partly truth, partly fiction. Walking contradiction.
You saying that about me?
Well, who else would I be talking about?
The writing of this film is such that it is not the telling of an event or the journey of a character. Well, yes, no plot is complete without events and the journey of the character from event A to B to C. But here, it's the point of view of a first-person narrator. That too, an unreliable narrator. We rarely get a glimpse of this world that is not through Bickle's eyes. We slowly make our way deeper into Bickle's mind. The best example of this is the opening sequence, how it has us looking at a cab driving through the smoke, and the final one has us inside with Bickle looking at the world through his eyes or even making eye contact with him. Because the last we see of him is his eyes in the rearview mirror. This is partly the reason why you can't root against him, why he makes such a good anti-hero, because in the situation that would have downright made you dislike the guy if looked at objectively, we see him trying to keep up with the world around him, desperately trying to fit in, even trying to reach out for help. We see his discomfort in awkward situations. He is defensive on his first date with Betsy because somewhere he recognizes they have different social standings and feels inferior. He makes a failed attempt at flirting with a woman at the ticket counter at one of the porn theaters he goes to. And you cringe with secondhand embarrassment. He's sincere as he tries to convince Iris to get out of prostitution. So, in seeing the world through his eyes, you get to know him better. It's almost like some Stockholm Syndrome kind of thing Scorsese manages to do to the audience, and De Niro takes it a level up. He avoids eye contact when Bickle is vulnerable. He does iconic improvisations and that disarming smile. It makes you really want to talk about how fucked up it is that we do not associate negative things with good-looking people and overlook the negative traits they have. How else do you explain Ted Bundy's fan following? I don't want to take any credit from the writing and the direction and the acting, but the fact Bickle looks like Robert De Niro has a small contribution in making him a successful anti-hero. But I won't go on and on about it anymore. It's a well-known fact that a bad-looking creep is always considered to be creepier than a good-looking creep, even if they're equally creepy. Then there's also the whole creepy versus charming dichotomy. The same thing can be considered charming or creepy depending on who is doing it, like how Bickle stares at Betsy from the street and then walks into her workplace and says he'd like to volunteer to her because she is the most beautiful woman he has ever seen. And he manages to get a date out of this interaction. She says yes to go out with him, and I sat there wondering, how does that work? He stares at her creepily and he walks in claiming he knows her better than anybody else around her. So maybe he does know her better. Maybe she needs an escape from her boring reality, or it's all just exciting to her, I don't know, but she clearly is the Madonna in the whole Madonna-her dichotomy. between the two women Bickle must save, at least from Bickle's point of view. The Madonna-her dichotomy is a psychological complex defined by none other than Freud, an ideological perspective that categorizes women as either angelic figures or sinners. How does Scorsese visualize this dichotomy and other weird stuff going on in Bickle's head? In the next segment. Betsy and Iris are opposite characters, the Madonna and the whore, a privileged grown woman and a disadvantaged child prostitute. But when they cross paths with Bickle, the narrative runs parallelly. They become the purpose he seeks. And when things don't go as planned, he chooses violence. How? To elaborate would be to give away the plot points. I'll refrain from doing that. So let's look at how Scorsese does not tell you these two are opposite characters, but he shows you. And he does that by showing you how they're seen by Bickle. When Betsy walks in, she's dressed in white, the sun-kissed angelic woman walking into the campaign office. We have Bickle's narration in the background, his diary entry about how she's untouchable, and if that is not convincing enough for you, you also have Scorsese as an extra looking at her, his eyes following her as he walks into the office. He can't look away. By the way, he also appears later in the film to fill for an actor who could not make it, giving the film kind of a meta feeling, because it is this interaction that sort of acts as a trigger for Bickle's violent side. When we are introduced to Iris, it's late at night. She stumbles into Bickle's taxi, asking him to drive away. But before Bickle can, her pimp, Spotty, shows up, throws a crumpled $10 note and pulls Iris out of the cab. This particular note kind of becomes a symbol for everything Bickle despises and keeps reminding him of his purpose. I was listening to what I think is the DVD commentary of the film in which Schrader and Scorsese talk about it. And Schrader says that Bickle is a character who is experiencing extreme existential grief but does not have the tools, awareness or education to identify that. And thus, he is frustrated, and his frustration comes out in the most American way. He picks up a gun. And though the film is pretty grim and has its slasher moments, the most terrifying scene for me is when Bickle goes to buy a gun. He meets a dealer in the cheap hotel room. The interaction is morbidly funny, but only till Bickle picks up a gun to see how it feels. Slowly turn towards the window and stops at two unaware strangers standing on the street. That's when you know Bickle has reached the point of no return. He has the gun, he has the intention, and nothing good is going to come out of it. And Scorsese leads you on, only to surprise you in the end. Out of irony, Bickle cheats himself out of the self-destructive destiny and must start all over again. This is what the end signifies. Bickle pursues something, fails at acquiring it, realizes he has a purpose, lucks out with it, and we are at the beginning of the film. Bickle in his taxi at night on the streets of New York, a ticking bomb waiting to go off again. You must have heard about Taxi Driver's influence on the 2019 film Joker, and it shows. One instance that made me go like, yep, that is definitely alluded to Joker, is where we see Bickle dressed in his best jacket, a maroon one by the way. Walking in the crowd to go talk to Betsy, he stands out. It's like he does not belong there. That's isolation inframed. When he sits with other cab drivers in diners, he phases out. We get the view of streets like one would when they're driving through them. We understand Bickle is racist by following his gaze on black people walking on the streets and then looking back at his expression looking at them. And also there's this monologue in the background that talks about the streets of New York needing some cleansing. After things go south with Betsy, we get a sequence of Bickle trying to get in touch with her. He calls her and speaks of sending flowers, the camera pans, and stops at an empty corridor. You question if this call is even happening. Then we see dying flowers in his apartment. He is falling deep in his delusion. And despite such dark themes, the film manages to be funny. Would you believe it? There is a dark, morbid humor running throughout the film. Never the laugh-out-loud kind, but the kind that amuses you while making you uncomfortable. like Dog Tooth by Yorgos Lanthimos, the one we talked about in the last episode. Bickle takes Betsy to a foreign porn film on their first official date. Scorsese describes Bickle's actions to be a result of an unconscious self-destructive urge.
I think he puts himself in a Catholic frame, let's in a Catholic reference, you would say the occasion of sin. He puts himself in those areas, which aggravates him the most.
He wants to drag Betsy to his level because he recognizes they are different, but when they stand outside the theater, and he confidently says, this is what all the couples are watching these days, you're amused at how, what would be the right word, naive or unaware this guy is. At one point in the film, he decides to train, to get fit, no bullshit, only healthy eating and working out and all that stuff. And then you see him pour alcohol into his breakfast. And all this disturbed frame of mind and antiques bring me to the final component of the holy triad of this masterpiece, the acting. You definitely don't need some random podcaster to tell you that Robert De Niro is a good actor. The man had already won an Oscar for goodness sake before this role. And here we have come past the analyzing phase to just geek about how De Niro shines here. Travis Bickle is not an out-and-out crazy guy. He's spiraling into something he can't control. What he can control is trying to seem normal. He gets a job, tries to impress girls, does what is socially acceptable to do. So his descent must slip out in smaller ways. There's no manic laughter to cue you into his madness. There's a distant look in his eyes. There's no nonsensical gibberish but awkward pauses when he talks. There's a smile that is equally charming and terrifying. However, Taxi Driver is not a film that impresses you right away, or at least that has been the experience, or at least that has been my experience. It engages you, yes, surprises you, impresses you, but leaves you thinking, is it as great as everyone says it is? And then you start to think about it because this is a film that stays with you. You question what is up with this guy. And then it begins to grow on you to the point that you go, yep, they are right. This is one of the best character studies. Here I also want to give a shout out to the podcast called The Cinephiles. They have amazing conversations on films. I listened to the one on Taxi Driver. The hosts not only help you read the film better, but gift you with behind-the-scenes info, trivia, and stuff. And I think that's about it. We have come to the end of this episode. For the next episode, I think we'll stick to the bleakness and watch a modern-day David and Goliath story from Russia. Do check out the podcast Instagram page @aroundtheworld_8mm to find more hints and other cinema-related content. This page will also lead you to what I am up to, that is, if you're interested. Find us on Instagram and let's talk films. And hey, don't forget to treat yourself with a good film this week.